Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, my hometown out there on the prairie. It's been not quite so cold this last week, which gave Clint Bunsen a little rest from car starting, which had started to lose its fascination for him. But I don't know, I felt a little dizzy and nauseous when it gets this warm. Somehow it's not right. You kind of lose your bearings. We need cold, cold weather to bring us to our senses. I think of those beautiful winter nights, the very coldest nights in January when I was a boy, and you'd strap on your skates and go down to the lake, and the lights were on, just some light bulbs out over the hockey rink, which was just boards and oval out, and you'd skate on the coldest night. There wouldn't be many people out there. It wouldn't be crowded with little kids. And the sound of the blades on the ice and the sounds of the sticks on the ice and the sound of the whack of the stick against the puck were like punctuation marks. You skated out there until you couldn't feel your feet anymore. And then you skated into the warming house and you sat with your feet up against the stove and you felt that beautiful flame coming up from your toes as the blood started to run through your body again. We need that to keep our concentration. Otherwise, we get lax and all sorts of things happen. People lose their concentration when it gets warmer because there is a relationship between extreme cold and intelligence. We know this. We don't know what the relationship is exactly because it hasn't gotten cold enough for us to figure that out, but it's there. It was on that day it got almost up to freezing in the afternoon, and there was a collision there on Main Street. Carl Krebsbach leaped out of his pickup truck and he ran over to Leland, who had rammed into the side of the pickup with his car, and he opened up his door and he hauled Leland out and he said, "Leland, you rat, pulling that in your hometown. Go do that in St. Cloud if you're going to go do that." Carl had been driving along Main Street, and Leland had been stopped at the stop sign, and he pulled and he ran into Carl's right front bumper. Carl said, "I'm going to go talk to your father about you because there's no point in talking to you about you, that's for sure, Leland. But I'll say one thing to you, and that is don't you go calling up my insurance company, because if you do, I'll come down on you with both feet, and I don't mean maybe. Give me your billfold." He took his billfold and he scooped all the cash out of it and he threw it down on the ground. He said, "Now go home." Carl walked down to the sidetrack tap. Leland is Wally's youngest boy, Wally, who owns the sidetrack tap. And Carl walked in. It wasn't a good day for Wally either. Carl told him all about it, and he said, "Wally," he said, "this can't continue. If he's going to pull this scam in this town, I'm going to call somebody about that raccoon deal, and I don't mean maybe. And I want you to know who did it if somebody should call and report him on that raccoon deal." "Okay. Okay," said Wally. Wally thought about it in the afternoon, and the bar filled up with people, kind of dizzy, nauseous people from this thaw that we were going through. They sat in the bar, and they were drinking, and the things that they were saying were even dumber than usual. Wally stood back there, and it's been a hard week for him. He's had the sidetrack tap up for sale now for 2 years. 2 years, and the agent in St. Cloud hasn't brought any prospective buyers around for the last year. He can't wait to get this thing off his hands. He's 70 years old. That's too old to be a bartender. Stand around and be the only sober person in a bunch of drunks is no fun. And it does somewhat reduce your faith in your fellow human being. He's had it up for sale for 2 years, and now he's finally decided to lower the asking price to $75,000, which just hurts. It just hurts. And he'd accept 50. He's that desperate. He'd accept 50. He'll ask 75. He's been so desperate now that he's put his own for sale sign in the window, such as it is, of the sidetrack tap. For sale, and his own phone number underneath it. He sat there listening to these guys in the bar. There were about 12 of them, and they were yammering on about this and complaining about that and going on and on about the government and whatever else. And finally, there was a crash. He picked up an empty mug, and he threw it on the floor. And everybody was quiet. He said, "I'm tired of listening to you. I've been listening to you now for 50 years, and believe me, that's more than enough. You guys going around with your brains unplugged, let me tell you, don't have the sense that God gave geese. I tell you, when you guys are all against something, that's when I know that it's probably a pretty good idea." Like this baseball stadium now that you're all talking against down in Minneapolis, this baseball stadium for the Twins. Oh, I know you're against it, but I don't care because you don't have the brains to find your way home. I tell you, the Minnesota Twins are an asset to this state, and if you think that the state shouldn't put a little money into an asset, then I just feel pity for you. That's all there is to it. Now you sit here complaining about the high salaries that ball players earn. Well, let me tell you, number one, that money comes from television. It doesn't come from you. It comes from across the country, and it comes into this state. And Number two, gentlemen, if you had any idea what a curveball was like, if you even went to a little league game and saw one coming in towards you, you'd know how hard it is to stand up there and hit that. You guys couldn't hit a curveball if you had a shovel in your hands. I tell you, I've just taken about enough of your guff and your moaning and your whining in here. And you come in here and you're talking to me about Dennis Rodman and him kicking that cameraman at that NBA game. Let me tell you, I saw that play. I was standing right here. It was on the television. It was right up there. I saw that play. That guy was shafted, let me tell you. Dennis Rodman come in. He had to go under the basket. That cameraman was in his way. Dennis Rodman tripped over that guy's ankles, and he fell down. And then the cameraman turns, and he aims his camera at Dennis Rodman, trying to get some look of pain or an obscene gesture or something from him. And that was when Dennis Rodman gave him a little tap with the toe of his foot high on the thigh. And then the cameraman thinks about it for a minute or two, and then he decides to go into a faint, and they carry him off. And the next day, the NBA goes into an orgy of self-righteousness, and everybody's trying to kick Dennis Rodman out of the National Basketball Association, and he's suspended from games. It costs him more than $1 million, and he has to settle out of court with that cameraman for $200,000. And you guys sit in this bar, and you tell me that you think Dennis Rodman ought to be kicked out of the NBA. Well, let me tell you, I've just taken about as much as I can. Now, he's a colored man. He's got orange hair. He's got tattoos. He's got earrings. You can no more defend him in this town than you can say a kind word about prostate cancer. But let me tell you something. That man got shafted. That man got absolutely shafted. If somebody tripped me like that and aimed a camera at me, I would have done just the same thing. Tell you, you're just too dumb for words. You're dumb enough to be twins is what you are. Tired of hearing you. Now get out, every one of you. And he kicked them all out of the bar. He ran them all out of the bar. It's the only bar in town. He kicked them all out and he locked the door. And he had just a moment of peace. That Leland is no good. His son Leland is no good. He hasn't worked a day in his life, and he's 35 years old. It's getting a little bit late to learn. Leland has been earning money in the worst kinds of ways by organizing chain letters. He's been doing all kinds of scams. He's been working scams on insurance companies. Leland, sometimes, you know, the prodigal son is the one who stays home. Not pointing any fingers, but you think about it. Leland sometimes will get into that old beat-up Taurus of his, and he'll drive that into St. Cloud, especially when there are big snowbanks on the boulevards, and he'll find a place to park. He'll park where there's a real high snowbank, and he'll cut a little notch in it so he can look and see approaching traffic on the side street. And he'll sit there in his car, and he'll wait. And he'll wait for a car to come along that looks as if its insurance is all paid up. And he's waiting for maybe a Mercedes, if he's lucky, or a BMW, or a Lexus. But he'll accept, you know, a Lincoln Town Car or something else. And one will come along, and he'll just go sliding out into that intersection. And wham, that thing run right into him. And he's filed more claims, gotten more money in small amounts from insurance companies from that car Now, he's very cagey about doing it, too. Always, you know, smaller claims, under $1,500, so they don't feel it's really worth their while to send their dogs out after him. And he'll sometimes wait for a big blizzard or storm, flood, something to come along, so he knows the insurance company is snowed under by other claims and they don't want to bother with him. He's been living off this for years. And Wally's ashamed of him. He's a crook. He's just an ordinary crook in the family. Oh, he has all kinds of different ways of cheating insurance companies. Sometimes he'll go find a dead deer in a ditch somewhere, and he'll put that in his trunk, and he'll drive off into the woods, and he'll hang that deer to a tree, and he'll go smash into it with the front of his car. Not hard enough to do any real damage to the radiator, but enough to get a little claim on his insurance. And then about 3 years ago, he hit the jackpot. He went into St. Cloud and he saw a Bambi bread truck come driving along. And he went shooting out. And as it so happened, that Bambi bread truck kind of coasted through the stop sign just a little bit. And he clipped Leland just ever so lightly on the front of that Taurus. Leland fell out of the car, lay there on the pavement. He was twitching. He was crying. He was holding on to the side of his head. He got himself a lawyer. They sent an insurance adjuster around to the hospital to settle up, and he walked away from that with $25,000. Never was able to go back to work, though he never had had a job in the first place, but he wasn't able to go back to work, so he started to collect disability from the county, and in the end, the county sent around a woman to help him do his housework. Because with the settlement on that Bambi bread truck collision, he'd been able to make a down payment on the old Everett house there in Lake Wobegon, this nice little house on the side street up by the Lutheran church. They sent this woman, Lou Ann, around to do his housework for him, and he wound up marrying her. So now he had the best of all possible worlds. He had a house, he had disability payments, and he had a wife who worked. Leland was all set. Never have to do another thing the rest of his life. That house, the Everett house, that was the house, you know, that's been owned by other people since the Everetts moved out years ago, but it still is called the Everett house because they were such unusual people. It was a house where the woman would wash the kitchen floor and vacuum the floors, and after she'd cleaned the floors, she'd put down newspaper. And she'd leave the newspaper down until the next time she cleaned the floors. Kids were the neatest, cleanest people. They went to school with their shoes shined, which really set them apart. Kids were always dressed as if they were going to church, but she left newspapers down on the floor. Her husband would come home from work, and he'd get down on his hands and knees to read the newspaper, to read the front page and the sports section, and he was a little nearsighted, so he was down there with almost his forehead touching the floor. He looked like a Muslim at prayer, walking, kneeling down there and reading that thing. They had slip covers on their couches and chairs. They had slip covers, and because she wanted to protect the slip covers, she would then put on plastic slip covers over that. And because the plastic was kind of slippery, they would put a blanket over the plastic slip cover. And because the blanket was still kind of new, they'd spread newspapers over the blanket. They were unusual. I don't know, there's only one thing you can assume about people of that sort, and that is that they are guilty of some kind of heinous crime that would lead them to keep their house in that sort of unnaturally clean condition. I just assumed that they were axe murderers. I assumed that they were. They left after a few years and moved away, and we still call it the Everett House. Anyway, Leland moved into that house with his wife, Lou Ann. She's a Jehovah's Witness. She goes around town about every week and a half to peddle her papers and sell them, and he's got the money from the insurance and so forth. Well, Wally kicked these guys out of his bar. They went down to the Chatterbox Cafe, and they were talking about Wally and how unbalanced he seems lately. And Dorothy heard about it. She's concerned. She called up Clarence Bunsen over at Bunsen Motors, and he walked over and knocked on the door. Wally let him in. Clarence said, "I saw your for sale sign out there." "Yeah," Wally said, "I got to get rid of this thing. No point in waiting. I've come down in my asking price. I've come down to 75,000, which really is painful, but I'm 70 years old and it's too late to be holding out for a better price, you know? You come down to 70 and time is your main asset. Money doesn't mean that much anymore. Money only means something to people in their 20s or early 30s, and you don't have any money then anyway, so it doesn't make any difference. Too old to be a bartender. Too old for it. I want to get out of this town. I've got my motor home, my conquistador, and I want to go out driving. I want to see this country. I've been locked up here long enough in this little prison back here. It's been too long. Being a bartender is hard on your legs, and it's even worse on your spirit. Because there is no freedom of speech for a bartender. You just have to stand back there and listen to them. And they're terrible. They are truly, truly terrible. They believe in God only because God agrees with them on most things. That's the only reason they believe in it. They sort of believe in the Constitution, but not for other people. They're against abortion, but they're in favor of capital punishment. They don't care much if it's the guilty person, just so long as somebody's killed. These people are just absolutely careless in all the most important things, and they're passionate about trivia. That's the only thing. I will say one thing for them. They are haters. They hate stubborn people. The ones who won't come around to their point of view. And they hate boring people because boring people keep interrupting them. And they especially hate people from the cities. Hate them more than anything else. But they save their real cruelty for their neighbors. Anybody from here who's any kind of a success, they regard as a traitor to their own kind. They are miserable, miserable people. I will say this for them. They're not afraid of death. In fact, they rather welcome it. Funerals, they have a pretty good time at. It's births and weddings they have a hard time with. Weddings, they are glad to put off as long as possible. Never would be their preference. I can't wait to clear out of this town. He wants to get behind the wheel of that big car and put Evelyn, his wife, in back with all of her books. Get behind that wheel and just make a big figure eight around the American West. Head out on some summer morning, early in the morning. Head out there through Wyoming, cross that grassland and open up that vent and just smell that grass, smell those mountains as it goes by. Pull over wherever you like. Stand, feel the sun, smell the breeze, eat your lunch. Drive down through Colorado, down through that beautiful Durango Valley, and drive down into Arizona and see the Grand Canyon. And head over to New Mexico and to Albuquerque and to Santa Fe, and then cut back across Arizona on Route 66. Follow that beautiful route through the mountains, that old two-lane road, those high hairpin turns without any kind of little safety barrier along in there. Just breathtaking. And drive up through the heart of California and drive up north of the bay, San Francisco. Drive up through that tall timber country and up through Oregon, through the forests and the sand dunes and the Cascade Mountains and go up to Washington. Up to the Olympic Peninsula. That's what he wants more than anything else. But he's got to get this bar off his hands. You know, Clarence said, some young woman probably going to come through here someday and she'll see what a great business opportunity this is. That's the person who could really make a go of this bar. It would be some young, attractive, but strong woman. Not a siren, kind of a sisterly woman. Stand back there by the bar, but she'd fill this place up. Especially if she knew a little bit about sports, but didn't disagree with people too often. No, some young woman make a go of this bar. But they both knew It was Leland's fault. Leland is the one who should be taking this bar off his dad's hands, but he's a terrible worker. He's come. He's worked in the bar. He'll be behind the bar, and then Wally go downstairs to the storeroom. He come back up. He's gone. Can't trust him whatsoever. And now he's involved in this terrible, terrible raccoon scam. It's the worst. He's discovered mail fraud. He's discovered direct mail advertising. And he's formed an organization called Nurture Our Wildlife. Now, N-O-W. And he's gotten mailing lists of children in the cities whose parents take them to concerts and theaters and museums. He's got mailing lists of innocent children, and he sends out appeals. They open the envelope, and there's a picture of a raccoon with a little frost on its whiskers. And he's looking up, and he has a kind of little plaintive look in his eye. And the letter says, "This is Ricky." Ricky's a raccoon. He lives here in Minnesota. And it's been an awful hard winter for Ricky. Ricky's not able to get the food that he needs. But for just $20 a year, you can adopt Ricky. You can adopt him, and he'll be your own. And every spring, we'll send you a snapshot and a letter from Ricky. Mr. Bowser down at the post office said, "You wouldn't believe the mail that pours in from these poor, benighted people in the cities who fall for this story about a raccoon." It goes on, the letter goes on, to talk about how depression is a great enemy for the raccoons. That's really their number one problem, is the feeling of being alone. The people don't care for them. They become despondent, and that's what leads them to hurl themselves into the paths of speeding cars. Nurture Our Wildlife, indeed. Somebody's got to report this young man, but I'll tell you what his problem is. It didn't get cold enough. That's the problem. I've never been cheated by anybody on days when it was cold. I've never been treated cruelly by people on days when it was absolutely the coldest here. Cold winter brings out the best in people. I mean it. It's good to be here with you. That's the news from Lake Wobegon. Where all the women are strong, the men are good looking, and all the children are above average.